There are copies of the paper here as well, I believe. And I'd like to open it for questions, Angelina.
Hello. We're going to alternate between taking questions here. And we have about 140 people joining us via webinar with really great sort of global presence. We have people from Ghana, Cambodia, India, Senegal, Costa Rica, Uganda, and Tanzania, to name a few.
Nice.
So if you would, please raise your hand. We have a couple people here, and we'll get started.
I'm Dan Norell from World Vision. And Elizabeth, thank you for such an excellent report.
Thanks, Dan.
And presentation to give a broad overview. Just around the question of enterprise income, household income, but also household assets in terms of net wealth, mm-hmm. net worth, net mm-hmm. equity, and then any kind of benefits on the children of the household. What's as you think about that, what are some of your recommendations around programming, both for donors and implementers, around, you know, trying to move that from a program level to actually benefiting not only the income but also trying to get the assets up? Because some of the criticism of assets or income is that the income's not always used for A, the children, or B, reinvestment in the
Right. You know, when I looked at the cases, I had to find ways to compare them, and so I did focus on enterprise income and enterprise profits and household income. You know, some of the studies looked at assets, but I didn't really focus on that. Some of the recommendations, I think one important thing is for us to realize that the smallholder household is unique. It is, if you're an ag economist like me, you're raised on the idea of the household portfolio, where the household has all kinds of resources, human resources, financial resources, social resources, and they have to allocate those resources in every decision period among really like three kinds of activities. Production activities, which are the ones we've been talking about, but investment activities are another. And so, and then the third one are consumption activities. And so, and investment includes things like health and education and those things that generate higher income in the future. So, you know, one of the first things that I think about in terms of why is it possible for an enterprise to have profits, but the household not is, you know, I mean, one possible explanation is, of course, reinvesting in the enterprise. And, you know, I don't have any evidence about that, but of course that's a logical first thought. But if the question is about, you know, what's the best way for them, what should they be investing in? Or I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that this is really an economic portfolio that the smallholder household, and that there can be multiple decision makers within the portfolio. And depending on the culture, some decision makers have more influence than others. And of course, I mean, I think all of us, at least those of us with gray hair, I mean, we all know that income, we know the evidence is strong that income to women tends to be invested more in children and their education and their care. So I would say, I'm afraid it's an inadequate response, but I would say we need to realize that this is not a simple decision, that this is a balance of many different activities that they have to allocate their resources to. Yeah.
Take one from the webinar.
This question comes to us from Gitao of West Virginia. Gitao asks, is it possible to have scale and participation presented as a ratio of smallholder farmers versus other farmers?
So is the question about what percentage of these are smallholders versus others?
Participation presented as a ratio of smallholder farmer versus other farmers. That ratio?
Jim?
It's a denominator versus a numerator issue. I mean, how many farmers if you're going to speak, we ask you to use a microphone.
Right. Oh, I see. Yeah, in some of these cases, it would be possible. In some of these cases, I could look at that. In others, though, I mean, it's hard to get information sometimes about how many smallholders are participating. But in some of these, in many of these cases, when we're talking about productivity investments and upgrading, we're talking about new ways of doing things, new technologies, in which case, you know, there is no baseline of people who are not doing it. You know, it's like the ones who grow the new crop are the ones who are able to sell into the value chain. Here we go.
Yeah. My name is Bob Vogel. I'm currently working with the IFC. I've done a lot of work in finance, but one of the things that's always occurred to me is risk minimization versus profit maximization. And what strikes me is that the advantage from the higher income, well, not the higher income, but the higher profits, are devoted to risk minimization and also to benefits that aren't captured, sending kids to school that you can now afford to do. So that
right.
doesn't come as part of recorded income.
Right.
Or a kid goes off to the city to drive a taxi and that income doesn't get reported.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, there's no surprise really because of the risk reward, diversification,
mm-hmm.
and all of
mm-hmm.
that, the importance of that, that you don't get this direct limit,
right.
Linkage between profitability and household income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good comment. I agree with you on that. And it kind of brings me back to Dan's question. And, you know, and what I didn't mention is that the household's not making their decisions based on just one criterion, like profit maximization. They're balancing lots of objectives, including food security, including the desire to build a better future for their kids and other preparing for retirement and those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Questions in the room?
Yes, Bill Grant from DAI. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. It was a very good, clear presentation.
Thank you.
I especially liked your emphasis on it's the behavior of the individual farmer. I mean, it's their choice. So really what we're talking about is behavior change,
right.
and what influences behavior change. I was interested in particular in your chart that you put up on the Kenya maize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it reinforced to me the fact that while we've taken individual projects here, that if you actually look at the range of other programs that are running simultaneously in the same countries, that there is actually an accumulated
mm-hmm.
effect of
mm-hmm.
all those things.
Mm-hmm.
In Kenya, when you saw the greatest increase in the uptake of services, also coincided with the creation of a media program
uh-huh.
on agriculture. And the
mm-hmm.
chief of party of the Maize Project said,
love it.
The biggest single beneficiaries of this event organized by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But it got the information out and really mm-hmm. created a dynamic that reached millions of people indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
So a great method of facilitation, but not tied necessarily directly to maize. It
right.
was actually started originally for dairy and other products.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you take that into consideration? You know, that kind of those externalities that actually lead to a direct effect. Into the assessment of the project's impact. Because we're going to look at one project, and yet it's actually the sum of the parts of all the projects around it that make it succeed.
Right. You know, that's a great question. And I've been working in impact evaluation for a few years now, and I have a prediction. I predict we're going to see a sea change, maybe in 10 years or maybe 20. But right now, we're very, very focused on what we want to attribute changes to a specific project. And I think that concept is getting outdated. A lot of people are moving toward what they call contribution analysis, where you look at what was the additionality of this project. Even that is hard. But I think your point is well taken, Bill, because One of the studies that's cited here and that's referenced in the back is that cross-country longitudinal study done by Michigan State University, Jim Umkey and Tom Jane. And so the value of that was that it actually was looking at the combined impacts of several different projects over time. And so, you know, maybe that's the way to go, is we have to start thinking about, you know, kind of combining forces on impact evaluations. Yeah?
We have a question from David of FAO from Rome, Italy. Does the research cover post-project impact assessments? Perhaps many farmers can be reached, but with project assistance remains a critical factor to driving adoption and upgrading. How sustainable are the results presented?
Yeah, that's a great question from Rome. And it's a great question, and it's something that is really bothering me a lot. I'm very much hoping that we'll get some resources in order to do post-project evaluation, because so many of these impact evaluations occur at the end of a project. And especially if we're talking about a facilitation approach where we think there's slow start and then a tipping point, and one of the justifications for a facilitation approach is that it's expected to continue with, you know, with full steam ahead even after the project funds have been are ended. But we don't have a lot of proof on that, I'm afraid. Maybe our friend from Rome can send us some information, but I would really like to see us do some post-project evaluation.
Questions in the room?
Hi, Laura Meisner from USAID FDA. I was just curious, I'm looking at the sheet and you mentioned the cross-country study in Kenya. And if I'm reading it right, it sounds like poverty rates actually went down more for indirect treatment households than for those who got direct treatment. And if I am reading that right, then I'd be curious to know if you had any thoughts about why that might be so.
Well, a couple of things might explain that. And one was that this was a study that looked at beneficiaries of several projects. Okay. So again, we can have variation in, you know, the type of benefits that were delivered. And it just may be that there was a facilitation project with indirect beneficiaries that that had a big impact. And there's another thing too that I've been seeing lately. You know, this is not completely unheard of. And you know, a lot of impact evaluations use this kind of, they use two control groups. They use a control group that's away in location, and they use a control group that's in the same location as the participants. And some of these are finding that it's the people who are in the areas but not participating in the projects who really gain the most. I mean, their income may not end up being higher than the ones who participated, but their gain, just, I guess, the demonstration effect. Another thing we haven't talked about also is that there are benefits beyond, there is outreach beyond the direct, indirect, and spillover. And then there are also multiplier effects that that can happen when there's a lot of money that's now circulating in a rural community. So I don't have a definitive answer, but I think it's very intriguing. But I would say probably my first response to your question is that there were a variety of projects, and that probably explains it. Okay.
I've got the Eric White, Integra. First of all, thank you very much for this presentation.
You're welcome.
Really, really enjoyable. Got a lot out of it. The question I have is, you presented evidence that shows that smallholders will make productivity-enhancing investments, and you talked about some factors that push them to do so or that pull them or allow them to do so.
Right.
And then you talked about some projects and showed how in different cases, different of these pull or push factors were sort of the driving force mm-hmm. in making productivity-enhancing investments. And the question I have is there a systematic way of evaluating which of these factors is going to be decisive? there are, I saw from the list of projects you mentioned, there were some instances where access to credit was what drove it.
Mm-hmm.
In another, it seemed to almost be hand-holding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In another, this gentleman mentioned the media program.
Mm-hmm.
In another, there may be an issue of security.
Right.
And how are we as project designers supposed to know which of those interventions is really going to relax the constraints? Is there a methodology to do this?
Well, I have an idea. I have a concept. And so if we think about it, and this kind of comes from, you know, if you look at graphs a lot, if you're an economist and you look at graphs, and you've got two different surfaces. So if we think about the pull factors, the market, as being a blanket that's coming down, okay? So just think it's something coming down. And so here it is right here. But we think about the households. Remember we said they're heterogeneous. And so some of them come up into the blanket and others don't, right? Okay, and then if we lower the blanket, then more households come under the blanket, right? But, okay, so I would say then a good approach is, first of all, to know what the pull factors are, but secondly, to be very knowledgeable about your target population, because it's within the target population that you'll be able to determine what's really needed to bring as many of those in as you can. Did that analogy make sense? It's coming down like this, but the people are uneven, and then if you bring it down, you're going to get more of them. Right. So the business enabling environment, the market can bring that. And of course, if we thought, oh, well, the market goes all the way down to the floor and then everybody's in, but that's not the way it works. Right. So I would say focus on the characteristics of the target population.
Carrie Max asks, what is the thinking that might explain the disconnect between higher farm profits and no significant impact on household income?
Yeah, he's probably heard a few of the answers already to that. And we talked about a leakage. You know, there can be leakage in that. We know that measuring household income is a pretty inexact science. And some people take a consumption approach, and some people take an income approach. And either way, it's easy to overlook some categories if they go into, if money is spent in ways that we're not measuring, that's one way. And we talked about reinvestment in the enterprise. That's another explanation. And then another explanation is the complexity within the household and who's receiving the income, who's receiving the farm profits, and then where are they going? I mean, I hate to tell this story, but I will. I mean, it was a recent story of farmers that were selling their crops into a great market, and they'd get paid on Friday, and that's when they went to the bar, and then that's where the money went.
Some scale.
Yeah, smallholder is, you know, of course, defined, you know, it depends on the productivity of the soil and the market opportunities. You know, I use, so it depends. In Africa, the holding can be larger if the land is not as productive, you know. In places where land is totally productive, you might call somebody under 7 acres a smallholder, under 5 acres. You know, there are smallholders that produce, like, you know, I'm really familiar with the case of high value vegetables in Guatemala, and there's some really rich soils there, and with very intensive labor, they can take a couple of 3 or 4 acres and make a lot of money. Whereas with corn, it's not the case. You need more land. And I don't know. I guess I kind of use a rule of thumb is under 10 acres. That's my rule of thumb. Oh, hello.
Hey, Elizabeth. How are you? Mark Freeman. I just have kind of a combination / comment. Having just come off of working on some deep fat proposals that are using value chain approaches, I was just curious. I couldn't tell from the list of projects that this study looked at.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those were funded by Title II? And I ask that because while they don't necessarily look their primary focus, of course, isn't implementing through the value chain. It's one of the tools that they bring to the table. But all of the data that they're gathering on the uses of that income at the household level, whether it's being spent on health or child education, might be kind of fun to go in there and kind of try to play around with some of those numbers and try to get at some of those questions that have been popping up today.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure about what's Title II and what's not. None of them. The answer is none of them. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
Jed Byers asks, what is the role of the private sector in helping commercialize smallholder farmers? What are the risks and benefits that result from trying to incentivize private sector actors to incorporate smallholders?
Wow. that's a big question. In terms of what can the private sector do, first of all, we know that larger firms, the private sector, that working with a large number of small holders is costly. And so mechanisms for aggregating, linking them horizontally so that you can work with the group rather than the individuals can reduce the cost in the private sector to the larger firm. We're also seeing that one of the most effective mechanisms seems to be branching out through the use of village agents, so that the firm, might be the large holder. I mean, sorry, the large firm might be located in the regional capital or wherever, but as inputs and procurement goes down to the local level, then it's possible for this large actor to really expand the number of smallholders that they're working with. So I'd say that. Okay. Yeah, Anna.
Anna Garlock from ACDA Boca. My question is about household income. You touched on that a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about the methodologies that were used in a few of these studies to measure household income? Was it looking at income over the course of a year? Was it one point in the year?
Mm-hmm.
Was it just capturing income from participation in a certain value chain, or was it really capturing all of the household portfolio?
Right.
And then, in your experience, what would you say are some of the better methodologies for capturing household?
Oh, that's great. I haven't had to struggle with this for a couple of years. The studies, not all of the cases reported on household income, first of all. And it was generally from the impact evaluations, the ones that had impact evaluations of them, that we got information on household income. And, of those, I'd have to look again, but I'd say several of those were MCC, and I think they use a consumption approach, if I'm not mistaken. I know that a couple of them, I'm familiar with them, they used an income approach. And there's always that trade-off between breaking it down into small pieces in order to get lots of good quality information, or asking in categories of income in order to make the questionnaire shorter and not bore the person terribly. So two of those studies I know used kind of an abbreviated income approach, and I go with the income approach, and I know that that very smart people disagree with me about that, but I go with the income approach because I think you can do it in a less tedious way. And so it, that requires a lot of pretesting to know what the different income sources are and to make sure that you're capturing that. And then, of course, you also have to be very clear about the periodicity of income. So in agricultural households, of course, we know they have a lot of, Right. Cycle over the year of income, crop cycles and all that stuff. So so you have to be very, very careful. You know, usually an impact evaluation is going to be measured at two or more points in time, right? And so it's critical in agriculture that those be in exactly the same period of the year. And that's really hard to do in practice. But it's very, very important for the validity of the data.
Carrie Nielsen asks, has a two-part question. One of the recommendations made is to have longer impact evaluation horizons. So the first question, is there a recommendation as to how long is long enough? And the second part, how do you balance the need for longer time frames while also trying to protect treatment and comparison groups from contamination by other projects over these longer time frames?
Now, see, this goes back to what we were talking about before. I do believe that our methods are going to have a big overhaul in the next 10 or 20 years, because the idea of isolating people to serve as perfect controls, it's just not that feasible. And secondly, you know, people use randomized control trials, and I respect that a lot, and I respect the kind of information that you can get from those. However, what I'm observing is that in the case of agricultural value chain projects, which have lots of different aspects to them, they may be working in the enabling environment, they may be working in inputs, they may be working on push factors for households. In order to do a randomized control trial of those projects, they tend to narrow down and only look at one aspect of the project. And even then, they and if you look, MCC has written about this, and you can look on their online on their page of their impact evaluations, and they've noted that, you know, the sequencing of project activities are really important. So if you try to measure the impact on households of a multi-part project where many of the parts have not been delivered yet, then you're not really getting a true picture of impact. So so the answer to the question, I think, is that we need to re-examine how we do impact evaluation. And I recognize there are a lot of trade-offs there. It's not as easy as it might sound.
We'll take a couple more questions.
Hi, my name is Kim Ha from AZMJ. You spoke about investment capital as a constraint or opportunity to increasing productivity, and cited reinvesting income or using in-kind capital as a means to make these investments. And I just wanted to know if you had any particular findings about which type of investment capital was more successful or what seemed to occur more often, any kind of observations you found.
A couple of observations. One is that it is different, the short-term and the long-term credit, because in upgrading, a lot of times, you know, well, there's one thing is purchasing the improved seeds, and that's a seasonal thing. You just need short-term capital for that. But if you're going to put in an irrigation system, you know, or do some terracing or something like that, you need some long-term capital. Short-term capital tends to be easier to come by. Microfinance tends to serve short-term capital a little better. Longer-term capital is harder to come by. I'm not really seeing a lot of banks that are reaching out to farmers for that. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the buyer, you know, has a vested interest in this smallholder upgrading, because then the buyer gets the products that they want. And so that's why in-kind credit, you know, from the buyer is often done. But when we talk about longer term credit, that's not quite as viable. I have seen a few cases where buyers provided 3 or 5 year credits for irrigation systems to be built, but they're really exposing themselves to a lot of risk when they do that. And so that's why we don't see it that often, I think. I think another thing to keep in mind here is to keep in mind that this is, that the smallholder household is complex, that there's a lot of stuff going on there. And over the years, I've found that the households that do the most investment are the ones that have additional income streams. Whether because the son is driving a taxi, or the daughter's gone to be a maid, or maybe they've got another person in the household now. And I haven't mentioned remittances. And that's another possibility. So
we'll take a final question from our webinar participants.
I apologize if I mispronounce your name, but Haben Berhe has a question. Was there evidence where agriculture technology adoption by smallholders significantly increased the push and pull factors you mentioned?
Where smallholder investment, one very clear way that happens is when smallholders invest and when they're successful, they set up a powerful demonstration effect. Okay. So, and many projects use demonstration sites just for that purpose. But you can imagine then, if I am sitting here and I'm thinking, I probably don't want to do that. I don't have the money. It's too risky. I don't even know if it works. Okay. But then my neighbor down the street, I pass by her house, on my way in and out every day. And I, all of a sudden I'm watching and her corn is growing and growing and growing. Right. So that would increase the push factors. All right. As far as increasing the pull factors, I nothing comes to mind right off the bat. Okay.
We'd like to thank everyone for their participation today, both in the room and via our webinar. We're going to go ahead and wrap up. So thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.